I want to thank everybody for coming to the Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah on Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. It's not working. I see. Okay. I'd like to thank everybody for coming to the joint Shari Shemaim Yeshiva University Torah Mitzvah on Beit Midrash Zichron Dov Haggadah night. Tonight's program has been sponsored by Jason and Raquel Goldberg in memory of their daughter Tamima, Aleha Shalom. Her neshama should have an aliyah. Tonight's program is going to be all five of us each giving an 8 to 10 minute insight into a different part of the Haggadah, insights that are good for sharing at your Pesach Seder, so hopefully you'll be able to take something from each one of us, at least one thing, and give it over at your Seder as well. There is a sign-in sheet at the back, so if anybody is interested to have a source sheet sent to them afterwards, or to get a link to an audio recording of the shiur, please sign in. It's at the back on the coffee table there. And I think, without further ado, we'll get the program underway. Our first speaker will be Rabbi Chassis, followed by Rabbi Straffler, Rabbi Diamond, Rabbi Turchiner, and then myself.
Thank you, Rabbi Grumlin. Can everyone hear me in the back? We're good? Thumbs up? Okay. So, Birshut all the Rabbanim here, it's really a pleasure and privilege to participate. And I brought my notebook because I plan on gaining a lot more than I'm giving. So I look forward to learning from all of my esteemed friends and colleagues on the panel this evening. So I was charged with Kadesh, with the beginning of the Seder. And I want to make three points. Three points. Just turn off. Can you still hear me?
No.
Okay, I'm going to hold it. Okay, I'm going to try to make three points about the beginning of the Seder. My time starts officially now. The first point is about how to start the Seder. I find that one of the most magical moments is the first moment of the Seder. When everyone shows up with their Yom Tov clothes and is about to take their seats, and you look around and you see family and friends, and you think about all of the preparation that went into this special moment. Hours of cleaning and scrubbing, hours of cooking, buying, and burning. So much went into making this special moment. I think it's important to acknowledge how special this moment is because of all the preparation that went into it. So what I do with my family, Sarah and I usually have a conversation depending on our guests, is we try and have a little bit of an icebreaker at that moment. Really before beginning the whole Seder, but when everyone is just sitting there or standing there before Kiddush. And Sarah and I have experimented with various different icebreakers, sort of just a very quick go-around for everyone there, depending on if we're with family and everyone already knows each other, or if there are guests that don't know one another. But we think about engineering the experience so that everyone from the very beginning feels like an equal and full participant of the Seder. So one icebreaker that we've used several times, which I encourage you to consider using, is invite everyone present to invite a grandparent or great-grandparent to the table. To provide the name of that ancestor and why they are choosing to invite that grandparent to the Seder. Feels a little bit like a Nushpizen of Sukkot, but I find that this helps cultivate an intergenerationality, a sense that we're connecting across generations to our own family through the Seder, and that those spirits remain with us throughout the Seder evening. So that's one thing that I do to sort of try and get people thinking and feeling that icebreaker. Another thing that I do is try and make a few rules about the Seder evening. One rule that I have used year after year, and it's not really my rule, this is something that the Aruch HaShulchan writes, that no one should pour their own wine or grape juice. At the very beginning of the Seder, I ask everyone to find a good drinking buddy. And by that I mean someone who you can share your alcoholic preferences with. The first two cups I want a mix of grape juice and this percentage alcohol. The last two I'm going all in. I want white, I want red, whatever Kabbalistic reason you have for that. And that way, people around you, there's already a feeling of warmth that's created, and ultimately a feeling of being served in royalty that's cultivated from the very beginning. And the reason that the Aruch HaShulchan writes this is actually a diyuk that he makes from a Mishnah in Arvei Pesachim that we learned recently in the Gemara Shir here at the Shul. The Mishnah reads, Mazgu lo kos rishon, that they poured the first cup for him, as opposed to him pouring himself. And so from there we see that people should be poured for on the Seder night because they really should be treated like royalty. So this is one gesture that we try and sort of create a structure around by making it a rule. Another rule that we make at the very beginning is that for every step of the Seder, and specifically for every paragraph of Magid, we go around the table and everyone has to take a turn either asking a question on that particular paragraph or being asked a question by the table on that paragraph. Meaning to say that if we're at the Arba Banim, so we read the whole thing together, and then whoever's turn it is at the table will have to either present a question to start a conversation on, or will have to choose to be asked a question. And we find that regardless of the age group, are the diversity of participants, that this is a little bit of an equalizer and helps everyone get involved in a substantive way. I recall fondly when I was on campus and Sarah and I were hosting seders for 50, 60 students from around the world. We used this mechanism, this rule of everyone has to either ask or be asked a question, and the Seder went until about 3-4 in the morning. We gave some competition to Rabbi Akiva and his students. It was a really special time. So I find that's a helpful way to create conversation. Okay, now on to actual Kaddish with a few minutes that I have remaining. I want to read a passage. This is going to be the second of the three ideas that I'm going to share. I want to read a passage from Rabbi Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik, in his book, Festival of Freedom, Essays on Pesach and the Haggadah, in the very first essay, writes beautifully about the Seder night that he remembered experiencing as a young boy. Let me start on a personal note. In my experiential, not intellectual memory, two nights stand out as singular, as endowed with a unique and fascinating quality, exalted in their holiness and shining with a dazzling beauty. The night of the Seder and the night of Kol Nidre. As a child, I was fascinated, indeed entranced, by these two clear, moonlit nights, both wrapped in grandeur and majesty. I used to feel stimulated, aroused, inspired, illuminating vision heightened my senses, which were sharpened and liberated from all inhibitions. A strange silence, stillness, peace, quiet, and serenity enveloped me. I used to surrender to a stream of inflowing joy and ecstasy. In a word, as a young child, I vividly sensed the presence of God. Of course, it is hard for me to now describe the state of mind of a sensitive child in genuinely childish categories. I am only portraying in retrospection the experiences of my childhood, availing myself of the categories of an adult mind. I can still hear the solemn, sad, nostalgic melody of Yach Nahaz, the mnemonic acronym for the order of the sections of the Kiddush and Haftarah, which I heard most probably at the age of 5.
when my grandfather recited the Kiddush on the Seder night that happened to coincide with the end of the Shabbat. I still remember the finale of the blessing, Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'Kodesh, who distinguishes between holy and holy. The melody gradually faded away, or shall I say was transposed into another melody, namely one of silence. As a child, I used to brood for hours over the notion of Hamavdil ben Kodesh l'Kodesh, two sanctities, one of the Shabbat and the other of the holiday. I liked both. I cherished every spark of holiness. I hated the everyday, the gray, the routine, the workday dreariness. All of these memories are at the root of my religious Weltanschauung and experience. Without them, I would miss the ecstasy accompanying religious observance and the depth and sweep of religious meditation and thinking. However naive and childish these emotions and visions have always been and still are, they still are the wellspring of my colorful religious imagination. For Soloveitchik here, in a word, waxes nostalgia. He feels the feelings of being a boy at the Seder table of his grandfather, Rav Chaim, listening to the bracha of Kiddush, Asher Bachar Banu Mikolam, that beautiful tune that transposes him back decades ago to the Seder table of his parents and grandparents, and now he writes about it and reflects about it as an older person. And this year, Kiddush is actually going to coincide with Shabbos and with Motzei Shabbos, so we're going to be overlapping our Kiddush with the special Kiddush for Shabbat and for the for Havdalah. I thought this beautiful depiction of the opening of the Seder would help us appreciate the value of nostalgia and thinking back to childhood memories and allowing those childhood memories to really animate our religious experience at the Seder night. The last thought that I'll share in the 30 seconds that I have remaining is a question about the relationship between Kiddush and the steps that follow. We're familiar with the roadmap of Kadesh, Rechatz, Karpatz, Yachatz, and then to Magid. And there's a question that is brought up by several Rishonim about Kiddush b'makom se'uda. Typically, when we make Kiddush at a se'uda, there is a requirement that the Shulchan Aruch describes as having the se'uda miyad, right after the Kiddush. The reason for that being is that the Kiddush is what makes the se'uda special. It sanctifies and elevates the mundane act of eating by endowing it with a certain sanctity. On the evening of the Seder, however, there is a long interruption, we could say, a long hefsek between the moment where we say Kadesh and by the time we get to Motzi Masa, that could be hours. So how could it be that these two elements of Kiddush and Se'uda are still paired together on the Seder night? And so various Rishonim have creative approaches to this, but the one that I'll share from Rav Chaim Falaji of 18th century Turkey, he says that on the Seder night there is a Kiddusha Arichta, that the element of sanctifying the meal is an elongated process. That yes, we move on from Kiddush and go to Urchatz and to Karpatz and to Yachatz and to Magid, but actually those are all considered to be part of the same process, which is building incrementally towards this elevated spiritual state, so that when we actually reach the Seuda, we are flying high with all the ideas, memories, experiences of liberty that we have
literally spoken of and tasted in the moments prior. And so whereas the typical Kiddush has a requirement of Zechirat Yitziat Mitzrayim on the Seder night of remembering Egypt, on the Seder night, that Zechirah is actually transformed into a Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim. It's not just a remembering, it's a telling in a way that's experiential. And so that Kiddush sort of bleeds out into and colors the rest of the Seder until we reach the Seuda. So in that way, Kiddush serves as a longer process for building us up to make the Seuda that much more of a spiritual experience. I'll pause there and hand it over to Rabbi Strauss.
Rabbi Chess spoke about nostalgia. Rabbi Chesed spoke about nostalgia. I'm going to speak a little bit about imagination. And
before I do so, I think that in regards to nostalgia and memories, I just want to take a couple of moments to reflect about Sina, Raquel and Jason. I want to reflect on Tamima, Raquel and Jason's daughter, and just the sense of what she would have experienced. And so much of the Seder is about the connection across generations. And to think about that feeling of what, you know, this little girl could have had and the wonderful young woman she would have been. It's something that, in that realm of nostalgia, is something that I'm thinking about on this evening. So let's enter the realm of imagination. I have a question for you. If you could have anyone at your Seder, could anyone in the course of Jewish history at your Seder, past or present, who would you have at your Seder? Who would you put into your room? Oh, I got an answer here. Yes, who would you put in your room?
Jonathan Sacks, perhaps?
Jonathan Sacks, still living.
I was going to say the same.
Another one, the same. I mean, I think that Rabbi Akiva might be nice. Akiva might be a good one. Maybe the Rambam. Might be nice to have him at the Seder too. Maybe Nechama Leibovitch. I think she'd have a lot of insights for the Seder. You can imagine all the wonderful people that we might want to bring to our Seders. But yeah, I think that for many of us, people that we most want to have at our Seders are our grandparents and great-grandparents. It'd be those that perhaps also are our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren. To have those people with us at our Seders as well. Sometimes the greatest things that we can imagine are the things that are closest to us. So we're going to look now at the Maggid section, the very beginning. And we begin with the words of Halach Ma'anya. This is the bread of the affliction, the bread of the poor person. And the question that I want to begin with is, why do we start here? Starting Maggid, why do we start with the matzah in our hands? There should be other, far more reasonable places to start with. I would think we should start from describing Moshe Rabbeinu. Maybe Yosef as the person who brought us first into Egypt. Why do we start with the bread? And in this respect, I think that often we become locked into our sections when we look at the Haggadah. We get to Maggid, we're like, oh, now we're going to start telling the story of the Seder. Up until now, it was just logistics. You took care of karpas, a little salt water, maybe a question, but that's not the real story. But when we get to Maggid, we assume that now the book opens up. But we often don't realize that Yachatz immediately preceded Halach Ma'anya. And after Yachatz, what do we have in our hand? A piece of matzah. And so we begin the story of the Seder from something which is almost an organic storytelling. That we're looking at the materials that are in our hands, and we say, oh, I have a matzah in my hands. Halach ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction that our forefathers ate in Egypt. Now, with our story beginning at this spot, we say the words, kol dechvin yeseh v'yechol, kol dechrich yeseh v'yifsach. Let anyone come and join us. And I believe that there's a message here about the nature of the Seder evening that goes beyond just the introduction of the words of Yachatz. And that is that freedom begins from a perspective of sharing. That slaves cannot share things. Everything that a slave has belongs to his master. He has no freedom with which to share that which is his. And so right at the beginning of the Seder, we express our freedom with the very material that is the source of our, or reflects our slavery. With the very halach ma'anya, we take that which symbolizes our servitude and we create freedom from it by saying, kol dechvin yeseh v'yechol, let everyone come and eat. And once we're sharing, once we're bringing other people in, we create community. We create an environment where we're not alone. Where we're able to look not just for our own survival, but we look at our brothers and our sisters, our neighbors. And that too is an expression of freedom. Because a slave has no family. A slave has no community. A slave only has one vertical relationship. The master and the slave. That's it. We, in sharing, create community, and that's the second expression of freedom. And then the third expression of freedom is what takes place immediately after Halach Ma'anya, where we take the Seder plate and we move it. We, as it were, pull away the bread of which we were just talking, and we engage the questions of our children, what's going on here? Is the meal over? Why are you moving the Seder plates? And that's the third element of our freedom, which is the ability to question. Slaves do not ask questions. You tell a slave to jump, the only question the slave asks is, how high? Slaves don't ask questions. And so immediately with the onset of the Seder, we engage in that process of questioning. Now, the Rambam talks about the concept of chotken at the matzos, that we grab the matzos and we're, the matzos is something which is always moving around, whether it be in the form of the afikomen or whether it be in the form of the Seder plate that moves along. But the story that we tell is not a story which is linked to a typical narrative arc. Rather, it's a story which is linked to materials, to actions. And so the moving of the matzah prompts the manishtana, which drives our story along. And I'm not sure about your seders, but in my seders there's always a tension. It's the tension between when do we eat, and the question, tension between, but wait, I have another question. These two forces exist at every seder. And these two forces pull at the text of the Seder itself in some way. Because there's nothing more annoying or frustrating as you're trying to express a thought of being interrupted with somebody's asking, wait a second, I have a question. And this creates a certain irony. Because the very term that we use to refer to the Seder night is the word Seder, which means order. And yet, the very structure of this telling of the Haggadah story is something without order. Questions break order. They create confusion. And the necessity of this structure creates the opposite of Seder. As the Torah says, Ki Shalcha Bincha Machar, that we demand the question to drive the Seder forward. And this creates that constant tension between order and disorder. Now, if you look at the questions that follow, do people have to have that in front of them as they're going along here? So I'm going to rely on your memory. Once at a Seder, actually this was with my kids, and it was at the point of moving the Seder plate along, and it worked. My kids actually asked the question, "Dad, why are you moving the Seder plate now?" And I was like, "Oh, that's it, that you should ask the Manishtana." So the Manishtana is four questions. That's what we need to hear. But if you look inside the text of the Haggadah, you'll find that there are not four question marks in the text. Rather, how many question marks are there in the Manishtana? One question mark. It's one question with four examples. And what this reflects is that there is only really one question that binds us together on the night of the Seder. And that is, why is this different? Everything is just a permutation of this one question, which is, why is everything different? And this question can be asked on the practical level of a child. It also can be asked on a more existential level, the adults. Why are we different? Why is the world different than the way it should be? These questions are questions that come up over and over again. We answer the question, Avadim hayinu leparo b'mitzrayim. You were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. V'yetzienu Hashem elokeinu misham b'yachas zakah v'zoren tuyah. And God took us out from there with a strong hand and an outstretched arm. V'ilu lehotzia kodesh baruch v'davotenu mitzrayim, hari anu v'neinu v'nei v'neinu mishubadim ha'inu leparo mitzrayim. And if God had not taken us out of Egypt, then we, our fathers, our children, and our children's children would still be slaves to Paro in Egypt. This is the story. This is the answer. The answer to all these questions of why is it that this night is different is brought out in this one story of Avadim Hayinu. Now, the examples that we give in the Manishtana all reflect a tension, a contradiction between different themes. On the one hand, the matzah reflects the fact that we are free, that is, the bread that did not rise. At the same time, we also have maror, which indicates that we were still slaves. And you might say that in Judaism, there are two types of holidays. There are feasts and there are fasts. And for the child looking in at any given holiday, they're going to say, well, what kind of holiday is this? Is this a happy holiday or is it a sad holiday? And when it comes to the Seder night, the sadness is mixed in with the happiness. We have the tears and we have the maror, the salt water and the charoset. All these things are mixed up together. So the child asks, which one is it? Is it happy or is it sad? And the answer is, both. Avadim hayinu, we were slaves to Paro in Egypt, v'yotzienu, and we were taken out. Such that both ideas are conveyed. Now, within this phrase also, there's another type of thinking which is brought forward, which is this idea of the ilu. And what if? What could have been? And I want you to think about some of the language that's used throughout the Haggadah. We say, halach ma'anya. This is the bread of affliction. We say, Avadim hayinu. We were slaves to Pharaoh in Egypt. We make statements about reality. But then there are other phrases that we also use. We use phrases like, Bi'ilu lehotzia kadosh baruch hu. If. We use phrases like, Ba'afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nebonim, kulanu yudimet ha-torah. Even if we were all great sages, there is contained within the Seder two types of thinking. The factual presentation about what is in front of us on the Seder, and also the realm of the imagination, the what if. And both of these ideas are expressed as well within the debates of the sages, the five sages that follows Avadim Hayinu. That even if we were all wise people, we'd still tell the story of the Seder. And then that story itself, in describing the opinion of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah and his opinion that we would even tell over the story both at day and at night, expresses this idea in two concepts. The idea of Yimei Chayecha Ha'olam Hazeh and Kol Yimei Chayecha Lahavi Limot Mashiach, and all the days of your life, to include also the coming of Mashiach. That we exist on two planes. We exist both in the here and now, in the questions of when do we eat? Avadim Hayinu, Matzazu, the pointing to the reality in front of us. But we also exist around our seders in the realm of the imagination, this transcendence, this element of the magical that Rabbi Soloveitchik so beautifully describes in his essay. And that we encompass both these things in the here and now, Yimo Yimei Hayacha, Ha'olam Hazeh, and also in the realm of Yimot Mashiach as well. And there's a beautiful idea here in what it is to tell the story of the Seder. And that is that the best Seder that ever existed, to have the best people around you, to have the top five or the best group, and you would say that this year was the best Seder that ever existed, there's always going to be next year. There's always that opportunity to tell that story one more time, because the Seder can never have that best experience. Because the Seder exists in the realm not just of the here and now, not just in Olam Hazeh, but also in Yimot Mashiach.
Good evening, everyone. In an evening that discusses questions, I want to begin with a question. Why have the YU rabbis taken off their jackets, and those of us who are in church might have not? Coincidence? I think not. I have no idea what it means, in order that it should act. I have no idea what that means, but it is an observation that did not escape me. Okay, thank you very much, Rabbi. Wonderful, I appreciate that. Good evening, everybody. The last of the four Banim is called the Sheino Yodei Lishol, the son who is unable to, in fact, formulate the question. And the Haggadah tells the parent, Ut B'tachlo, the parent has the responsibility, if a question is not forthcoming, to begin the conversation. And a proof text is brought, Shene Amar, V'higadata V'bincha V'yom Amulei Mor, V'avur Zeh Asah Hashem Li V'Zeitim Mitzrayim. Translated, you shall tell your son on that day, you tell your child on that day, it is because of this that Hashem did all these miracles for me when I left Egypt. Having quoted a pasuk from Sefer Shemot, which is the discussion of the Exodus experience, the next section of the Haggadah is as follows. I'll read it in Hebrew and translate it to English. Yachol Meiros Chodesh Talmud Lomar Bayomahu I Bayomahu Yachol Nibod Yom Talmud Lomar Ba'avur Zeh Lo Amarti Ella Bisha'a Sheyesh Matzah Umaror Munachim Lefanecha. One might think, the Haggadah states, that from the beginning of the month there is an obligation to discuss the Exodus. So again, the Pasuk said, you shall tell your son, Vigadatul Bincha. The Haggadah says, you might think that that obligation to discuss actually begins earlier than the Seder night. It begins at the beginning of the month of Nisan. The Torah therefore states, on that day, Bayomahu. On that day, however, meaning it's not on the beginning of the month, it's on that day. On that day, however, it could be understood to mean only during the daytime. On that day. Day usually refers to the hours of light. Therefore, the Torah specifies, it is because of this, Ba'avur Zeh. The expression, because of this, and this is usually a demonstrative pronoun, which means you're pointing to something. Ba'avur Zeh, because of this can only be said when matzah and maror are placed before you. So what I'd like to do with you this evening is share two thoughts. One, on why does the Haggadah, which is quoting the Midrashic work called the Mechilta, why was there an assumption that one might think that the obligation to talk about the Exodus predates Pesach by 2 weeks? Why would we associate that obligation with Rosh Chodesh Nisan? And then secondly, I want to share with you an insight into the answer from two different sources. So let's do the first idea. What is it that might have led us to think that the discussion of the Exodus ought to begin with Rosh Chodesh. Rav Yehuda Leib Ginsburg was a rabbi living in Lithuania and emigrated to the United States and settled in Denver in the early 1930s. And he wrote two important works in his life. One was a commentary on the Torah called Yalkut Yehuda, and the second was an explanation of Nevi'im Rishonim called Musar HaNevi'im. And in his explanation to the Torah in the Yalkut Yehuda, he offers an introductory essay to Perek Yud-Beit, chapter 12 of Sefer Shemot. And as many of you know, Perek Yud-Beit begins with the first positive mitzvah given to the Jewish people. And what is that? Rosh Chodesh Hazeh Lachem Rosh Chodeshim L'Chodshei HaShanah. Where Hashem establishes the primacy of the month of Nisan. So that forever, when we ever teach children in school what are the months of the year, what's month number one, it is Nisan. So whereas, up until that point, Tishrei was the first month of the year, Hashem says, not anymore. From this point on, Nisan will be the first month. And of course, that's the case in the Torah. When you take a look, for example, all the holidays in Tishrei, Tishrei is month number seven. It's not month number one. So in his commentary, Yalkut Yehuda, Rav Ginsburg attempts to explain why. What's the message of establishing the primacy of the month of Nisan? Or, to state it slightly differently, if Tishrei is the month that commemorates the creation of the world, why would that not be considered so significant that we should be counting our days and months from Tishrei and not from Nisan? So I'm going to read part of it, a small section, and then we're going to translate as we go along. Dehine behabriya bichlala hinenu ro'im ki chok echad sholeit ba. Because from the entirety of creation we see that there is a single law that rules. Vehu ki hachazak boleya et hachalash minas. That the strong devour the weak. Kein hu ba'olam hatzmachim, v'chein hu ba'olam shel ba'alei chayim. It is true in the world of vegetation, and it's true in the animal kingdom. U'mitoch ha'histaklut b'ha'hofa'a zot. And from our examination in this phenomena, ba'u ha'anashim lidei hade'a, ki hadin v'ha'mishpat hu im ha'chazak. From this phenomenon, there came those people who concluded that the law is with the strong. Ki hateva nitna lo et hazchut hazeh b'zeh shehu hatakif ha'elein. Because, says Rav Ginsburg, nature itself endowed him with this privilege because they are the aggressor and they are the strong. They will endure. Mi shehakoach biyado, hu hamerkaz bitoch hachevra. For he who has strength in his hand becomes the center of society. V'chulam lo nivru'u ela l'shamesh lazeh. And all of society was created only to serve those at the center, the strong. That is what we might conclude. Umitoch ha-hashkafa hazot, and from this perspective, ba'u lidei hade'a ki ein shum zehutim leha'avadim. And from this perspective came the conclusion that there are no rights or zehuyot, no privileges for slaves. Mipnei shehema hashvelim v'hanichna'im ve'umlalim hema mitzad habriya, because they, the slaves, are dejected. They are the most destitute of all creations. Ha'olam lo nivra ela bishvil hatakifim. The world was only created for the strong. V'chol ha'am lo nivra ela bishvil l'shamesh lazeh. and the entire nation was created only to serve the strong. One word, says Rav Ginsburg, to wrap that whole idea up. Mishpat echad yisodi yesh ba'olam. One could say that there is one prime rule in the world. And what is that? Kol de'alim gvar. Whoever is strong dominates. Says Rav Ginsburg, that's the message of Tishrei. Tishrei is the month of the creation of the natural order. And a close examination of the natural order would reveal survival of the strongest is the rule of law. Rav Ginsburg goes on, and I think in a transformative comment, and explaining why Nisan is primary, states the following. When we come to understand that God created the world, through our examination of the order of the universe, we could come to the opinion, because the Creator Himself, if this is the way God created the world, then He sanctified this order. It's God's world. It's His nature. And if the rule of nature is the rule of the strong, then maybe that's been sanctified by God Himself. And I'm skipping over part of the paragraph, although it's powerful. It's powerful. And I'm getting to the end. Mipnei shehadavar hazeh moreh otanu, this matter teaches us, ki tzrichim anachnu liyot zehirim, we must be careful, v'torat hatzedek v'hamusar hachevruti, that one must be careful with the law of justice and social morality, v'lo liyot kalila min harodfin, we must never, God forbid, among the predators. The chain mitam zeh, and for this reason, Rav Ginsburg posits, chaviv yoter lifnei amakom, it is more beloved before God, shimnu et hachodashim minisan, that we count the months from when? The month of Nisan, milimnot mitishrei, from counting from Tishrei. Mipnei, because inyan yitziat Mitzrayim, the matter, the lesson, the message of the Exodus, machriya yoter al inyan briat haolam, is more influential, is more necessary. Its lessons are more enduring and more critical to the well-being of law and society than the law of nature. And so, says Rabbi Ginsburg, that's why Hashem says, from this moment on, we count from Nisan, because the messages of justice and social morality are that critical. So going back to the Haggadah, I know exactly why we should be talking about Pesach from Rosh Chodesh Nisan. Because of this! Because this is a transformational concept which rocks the world. Let's begin to declare this and assert this from the moment that the onset of Nisan takes place. That's why we should. That's how important it is. Even God apparently thinks it's important. He changed the order of the months. And yet the Haggadah, quoting the Mechelta, says, it's true, it is important. But we're not going to do that. We're going to wait till we're all sitting at the Seder table. We're all going to wait till we're sitting at the Seder table. And till Matzah and Maror, Munachim Lefanecha, are placed before you. So that's the first reason. Why might we have thought we should start talking about it in Nisan? I think Rav Ginsburg gives a very compelling explanation. But now we're going to go to the answer. And the answer is no, you must wait until Matzah and Maror, Munachim Lefanecha. Rav Shlomo Kluger was a rabbi in Brody, Galicia for over 50 years. He died at the age of 86 in the year 1869. During his 86 years, I believe, he was a very prolific writer, and he wrote 160 volumes. That's an enormous amount of books. Enormous. Only about, I think, 15 or so have actually been published. But one of the ones that's published is his commentary to the Haggadah called Ma'asei Yedei Yosef. And in one of his essays on this section, and he has multiple explanations. He's a very deep thinker, and he looks broadly at opportunities to explore Torah thought. In his discussion on this section, when Matzah and Mora Munachim Lefanecha, he applies a classic rabbinic interpretation by first looking very, very carefully at the words and suggesting that if something could be written in a more economic fashion, the fact that it was chosen to be written with more words than less usually indicates a reason to pause and to think of what the message was. And this is his question on that part of this paragraph. And he says the following. He says that when you look at that phrase, Ela b'sha'a sheyesh matzah u'maror munachim lefanecha, he questions the word munachim, that you can only talk about the story of Exodus when matzah and maror are munachim lefanecha, which literally in English means are placed before you. But within the Hebrew language, if you eliminated the word munachim, the sentence makes perfect sense. B'sha'a shematzah u'maror lefanecha. And so he begins an essay exploring what was the Mechilta and the authors of the Haggadah who adopted this section. Why did they use that word? What's the message? And Rav Kluger in his essay suggests that for him, this phrase is associative. It talks about two things in front of you, matzah and maror. And for him, in fact, it's not just two things, it's almost as though they're opposite things. And the idea of having two things in front of you suggests a matter of choice. And in his mind, this notion of placing two things in front of us and challenging us, beckoning us to make a choice, reminds him of yet another pasuk in the Torah, which two things are placed before the Jewish people. And God beckons to us. And he says, make a choice. And this verse comes at the very end of Sefer Dvarim, where Hashem speaks to the Jewish people and he says this, Re'ein atati lefanecha hayom, I have placed before you today et ha-chayim ve'et ha-mavet, life and death. Life and good, and et hamavet ve'et hara, and death and evil. And then a few psukim later, the Torah continues, Ha'idoti b'chem hayom ad ha-shamayim ha'aretz, I shall bring the heaven and earth to bear witness against you, says Hashem. Ha'chayim v'hamavet netati lefanecha, I have given before you life and death, bracha uklala, blessing and curse, and the two words, u'bacharta b'chayim. And you, says God, choose. But I tell you, I urge you to choose life. Says Rabbi Kluger, for him, this phrase of matzah u'maror munachim lefanecha, they evoke the same feeling as saying choose between chayim and mavet. And he believes that the symbols of matzah and maror are symbols of chayim and bracha and mavet bara. Matzah, he says, is the symbol, he believes, actually he does it the other way. First it begins with the symbol of maror. Maror, he believes, is the symbol of evil. And it's interesting because he tries to suggest, actually, it's experience, the taste experience would seem to begin that way. You eat it, and it doesn't seem to be that unpleasant, but its unpleasantness of the taste of maror begins to develop after. He says, that's the way of evil. That's the way of deception. That's what happens to us when we go down that road. Sometimes it doesn't seem to us that that road leads to a darker place, but that's what it is. That's maror. Matzah, he says, you know, matzah looks like it's a very inexpensive, it's a dull, it's an impoverished food. But he says that as an impoverished food, it's very satiating. It fills you up. And he says, filling you up is good, because we need to be sustained. And he sees matzah is that food of sustenance that fills you up. And so I'm just going to read a section from what he wrote here. Ikar Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim Nitkan Rak LeBeinoni. He says that the essential point of the entire mitzvah of the Sipur Yitziat Mitzrayim is to challenge those of us who are in the middle of life. We're mediocre. We're the average Jew. We're not the righteous and we're not the wicked. We're the average person that has to lead our lives meeting challenges, making choices. Sheshnei drachim unachim lefanav, because there are two paths that lie before him. Haderach hatov, haderach hara. Before each of us who we see ourselves as typical Jews, before us lies two choices, the good path and the evil path. Therefore, maror, its beginning is soft, and yet its end, however, is hard. Matzah, however, as I said, says Rabbi Kluger, that becomes representative, a symbol of life and good. V'zehu she'amar ha-magid. And this is the point, says Rav Kluger, in this section of the Haggadah, when the Haggadah says, Ba'avur zeh, because of this, the Sha'ashish Matzah Maror Munachim Lefanecha, when Matzah and Maror are placed in front of you, and he says, it's an amazing statement. Shehem Munachim Lefanecha Tamid, Kol Hashana, because these matters, Matzah and Maror, good in life, they're not just on the table one night, they're in front of you forever. Every day of your life. And both paths are in fact of equal opportunity. You can choose one or the other. This story, the Yetziat Mitzrayim, says Rav Kluger, this story is an essential story because it's the story of choosing. It's the story of choice. It becomes the story, not just of the Jewish people, it becomes the story of your life and my life. My mother, Zichrona Levracha, many of you know, is a Holocaust survivor, and she could be relied upon almost every year at some point in the Seder to ask, why is there no official formal mention of the Holocaust in the Seder text? Because as a Holocaust survivor, she understood and she clearly identified the experience of the Jewish people in Mitzrayim with her experience as a camp survivor of Auschwitz. But what I think connected her so much, at least connects me through her, is the fact that as a survivor, she made a choice. She lived her life making a choice. And she could have chosen one choice of the choice of Maror or the choice of Chayim. And God, you know, Baruch Hashem, we are the benefits of her choosing Chayim. And I think essentially what Rav Kluger was saying is that this evening that we celebrate the Seder, we sit at the Seder, it's not just about a historical recreation or reliving of the historical drama of the Jewish people, although it is that. But it is also a moment of personal choice about the type of individuals we want to be. Matzah u'maror, become the symbols of the direction we want to move in our own lives. Let me just end with an interesting observation, I think, from a Hebrew etymological point of view. The word vihigadata comes from is connected to the infinitive lehagid, which is only a biblical word. In modern Hebrew, it's not usually used, except perhaps in the infinitive and the first in the future tense. Interestingly enough, the shorish of lehagid, vihigadata, is nun, gimel, dalet, which normally would spell the word neged, opposed to, opposite. In other words, when you say the word, the infinitive, lahagid, it's of the type of construct in which the first letter of the shorish drops. The full version of the infinitive would be lehangid, which would be to put somebody opposite. That's what lahagid technically, in its purest etymological form, means, lehangid. Vehigadita lebincha, therefore, would mean, and you shall put your children opposite. That's what vehigadita means, in its pure words. But what would the message be? I think what the message is, when we say to about our children, vehigadita lebincha, what we're saying is, we have to give our children the strength to stand opposite the choices and to make the right choices. I cannot prevent the choices from being made. But the Higadita Labincha, the Torah is telling us, the Haggadah is saying, on this night, where this becomes such a critical evening, it's an evening of teaching, it's an evening of influence, it's almost a crucible of choosing between two paths, Higadita Labincha, Make sure that when this night is over, what you've done is you've enabled your children to stand opposite the choices that will come up in their lives, and you give them the tools by which to make those choices. The chen yiratzon, may each of our seders apply to that and give our children, next generation, the opportunity to be strong and committed Jews. Thank you, everybody. Good evening. And like the others, I want to thank Raquel and Jason for dedicating the evening in memory of their daughter, Tamima. I also want to thank the Office of Shari Shemayim and Shari Shemayim Adult Education for preparing this program with us. For my presentation, there is a source sheet which is on the table in the back right next to the sign-up list for those who want to get the audio recording from tonight. I'll also make two other quick announcements. One, that at the end of the program, after Rabbi Grumlin speaks, there will be a brief announcement from Mickey Ostro. And second, that there is another Haggadah night to be held at Shari Tefillah on April 13th. That will feature two other members of the Beit Midrash, Rabbi Ziering and Rabbi Rosenzweig, as well as Rabbi Grunland and myself, and I believe at least three out of the four Divrei Torah will be new, will not be from tonight. So what I want to present is a brief, underscore brief, but I think important thought based on the Haggadah, but with applications throughout our Jewish lives. And I go to the Maggid in the middle of the Maggid, the section that starts with the word Vanitzak. When I was growing up on my parents' Seder, I thought of Maggid as interminable. It was just going to keep on going and going and use whatever battery you like. It would never run out. And the transition for me was when I started to perceive the structure and to understand where things were going and what the stages were within Maggid. And Maggid really has seven stages. The first is the introduction about telling the story and about asking questions, the part that Rabbi Strauchler commented on. Then we start with our Gnut. We talk about the degradation of our origins with Terach, our idolatry, our slavery, or I should say our descent to Egypt. Then we move into a third, and that's our slavery. And then you get to the middle. And the middle is Vanitzak, when we cry out to God. And to me, that's the fulcrum. That's the point where things start to change. And then after that, God hears our cry, plagues, miracles, we bring the Karban Pesach, and we thank Hashem. And once I started to understand where things were going and what the stages were, it made it easier to digest, so to speak. But I want to talk about that middle part. This, and we cried out to God. I brought you source number one. That's the sentence we're quoting in the Haggadah, in which we are told the Egyptians harmed us and they oppressed us and they set hard labor upon us and we cried out to Hashem, God of our ancestors, and God heard, and so on. Now that's a very brief digest of what appears in Parashat Shemot, in the story of the Exodus itself, in the book of Exodus, source number two. And it was, after many days, the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned from the labor, and they cried out, and their wail rose to God from the labor. And God heard their cry, remembered his covenant, and so on. And what catches my eye in this description is the question of, why now? Why at this point? They have been slaves for a long time. Not clear exactly how many years. Before this moment when the Pharaoh dies. Now they cried out, now they groaned, and now God heard. Does that mean that until now they didn't cry out? Does it mean that until now they cried out but God ignored them? Why is this the moment when God hears them, the moment when God listens to them? And there are many answers that are offered. One answer that's offered in source number three, Rashi quotes a midrash that suggests that Paro did not actually die, but rather he became a mitzora. He developed an ailment of the skin, which required that he bathe in the blood of Jewish babies. That's one answer that is offered. The reasons for that midrash, how that midrash comes to this conclusion, are fascinating, but not for an 8 to 10 minutes of our Torah. But that's one answer that's offered. I have a problem with it simply because that's not what the Torah actually tells us, and therefore, even if it's what's going on behind the scenes, the Torah means for me to understand something else. There's something else that the Torah wants me to understand because it didn't mention the tzaraat explicitly.
A second answer that's offered is simply because our time wasn't up. Abraham was told we would be in Egypt for 400 years. Our time wasn't up yet. And so, I brought you the verse with the 400 years in source number 4. And so, yes, maybe we cried out beforehand, but it wasn't time for God to listen. And that's one answer. However, that's difficult, because if that's really true, then why do you mention Pharaoh's death at all? And why is it that God responds to our cries? He didn't respond to our cries. He responded to the clock and said, 400, you're done. So I have a difficulty accepting that answer also. A third answer is that we were idolaters, actually, until this point. Both the book of Yahushua, Joshua, which I brought you in source number 5, as well as Yechezkel, mentioned that the Jews in Egypt, or at least some of them, worshipped idols. But that just brings me back to ask the question, so why do you stop now? Pharaoh died and you decided to stop going to, you know, whatever temple it was? Could be. Fourth answer is from Ramban. Ramban says they gave up hope now. I brought it for you in source number 6. Ramban suggests that they're enslaved. Pharaoh dies. They think things are going to get better, and they don't get better, and that's when they cry out. My problem with that answer is that it's not what the verse said. The verse actually said, he died and they groaned. It didn't say, he died, there was a new king, the work continued, and they groaned. That's missing. So, that's my problem here. My problem is, did they not cry beforehand? Or did they cry and God ignored them? And the answer that I'd like to present is really a statement about prayer and how prayer works. If you take a look at source number 7, you find Maimonides' formulation of the mitzvah to pray. Maimonides writes, there is a commandment to pray daily. It's a biblical mitzvah, according to Maimonides. No matter what's going on in your life, happy, sad, doesn't make a difference, there's a mitzvah of prayer. And he says, not the number of prayers, although we do find biblically Daniel prays 3 times a day, and we had offerings that were brought at different times during the day, nonetheless, there is no mitzvah of you must pray 3 times a day biblically. The text of the prayers is not set biblically either, for the most part. And prayer doesn't have a biblically set time either. Shema, morning and evening, but not prayer as a whole. Rather, he says, the commandment is to ask God for your needs daily. You begin by praising God, you make your requests, and then you praise and thank. That's Maimonides. Nachmanides, Ramban said, uh-uh. I brought it for you in number 8, the Hebrew's at the bottom of one side, the English is at the top of the next side. Nachmanides said that's not what prayer is. He first talks about his perception that there is no mitzvah of praying daily biblically. Rather, he believes the mitzvah is to cry out to God when you are in trouble. If you are in trouble, if you have a great need, the mitzvah is call upon God. And look at his wording. He says that the exegesis of prayer has a biblical root. If prayer can be derived from the Torah, we will count it in the Rambam's count. We'll say it's a mitzvah, but what is the mitzvah? In a time of troubles, to believe that God hears prayer and saves from trouble through prayer and crying out. Shana'amin, he writes, the mitzvah of prayer, according to Ramban, is not a mitzvah of speak to God. It's a mitzvah of believe that God will hear you. That's what it is. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein notes this in source number 9. He says, it is noteworthy that the Ramban speaks of a duty to believe that tefillah, prayer, is efficacious, rather than of a duty to pray. It's about belief. And frankly, I don't think that Maimonides necessarily disagrees. Because when you look at the way he structures prayer, he emphasizes not only making your request, but also describing God in the prayer as one who responds, one who is capable of responding and who does respond. He has the same element of faith in it as well. It's about the faith. It's about the belief. You know, here at Shaare Shemayim for the last year and a half, I've been learning with a group of masochists. We've been studying the book of Job week after week after week. And And one of the themes in Job is how his visitors, particularly Eliphaz and Elihu, keep on calling upon him to pray to God, pray to God, pray to God over and over. But Job's been praying the entire time. The whole book, he's been saying to God, why are you doing this to me? Why are you not just? When will you speak to me? He's been calling upon God the entire time. But what's been missing and what they're trying to get him to do is to believe in a divine response. To believe that God will do something for him. And that's what he isn't getting. I brought in 10 and 11 a little bit of that exhortation for him to believe. But I think that's what takes us back to the Jews in Egypt and to Pharaoh. Until this moment in time, Pharaoh, is dominant. He is the one who enslaved them. He put them in this position, and as far as they are concerned, there is nothing we can do about it. Pharaoh dies, and now they believe. They believe there is a moment here that they can grasp, where they can call out, and that God will save them. And no, their faith is not perfect, because if the faith were perfect, it wouldn't depend on whether there was a Pharaoh or wasn't a Pharaoh. They would just believe God can take us out and that's it. It's not perfect. But now they believe they have an opportunity. And so rather than read that verse when it says, and we cried out as a moment of misery, as a moment of suffering, as, how terrible this is. I don't see it that way. I actually see it as a moment of, here's our opportunity. We can now cry out, here is our chance to appeal to God. It's not simply misery, which it's been until then. Now it's hope. And that's the moment when they cry out to God in that way. That's the moment when Hashem responds. When they express that belief. This non-cynical, faith-based, hopeful prayer is what God heard for the Jews in Egypt. This non-cynical, faith-based, hopeful prayer is what we develop through our Seder. And this is what Hashem heard for the Jews then, and may Hashem hear it for us as well. Thank you.
Just before I start, I want to say that when we had originally envisioned this program, we had envisioned it as a 1 hour approximately program. We are now about 3 minutes over that 1 hour mark. If for whatever reason you do have to go, we will understand. Again, there's a sign-in sheet on the back table. You can sign up there and receive an audio recording of the whole thing. With that said, I'm going to proceed now. We tend to look at the Pesach Seder and we look at it in various parts. We primarily have the beginning part, the middle part, and the end part. The beginning part being Kiddush until Magid, and that takes a long time. And that's really the time when everybody wants to talk and ask questions and discuss what's happening at the Pesach Seder. And then you have the time of the meal, and everyone is very happy about that time of the meal because they've been waiting for it for a very long time. And everyone wants to eat, and the conversation stops. And then at the end you have singing, and that's a lot of fun, and we look forward to it too. But really I want to look at this middle section. Why do we stop talking when we get to the middle section? Primarily I want to look at three parts. They all start with the letter Mem, with Mosi, Matzah, and Maror. Why does the conversation stop? Because we look at the Pesach Seder, and we're saying this Seder is supposed to represent the Exodus from Egypt. And so we tell the story of the Yitzhak Mitzrayim, during Magid primarily. And then we say, okay, I've finished telling the story, now let's eat. And I'd like to try to show that really, Mosi, Matzah, Maror, these are part of the retelling. That when we're involved in our Pesach Seder, we have to be involved the whole way through, and we should be always questioning and always looking for more meaning and more insight into our Exodus, even beyond the Magid. And I'd like to show how Mosi, Matzah, and Maror really show how express, really, that we emerge, how we emerge as a free nation, how, as this new nation, we developed a profound relationship with Hashem and brought that freedom into more of a reality, and how that freedom needs to be understood in light of the slavery which we endured. Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Cook, in his commentary on the Haggadah and Olat Raya, second volume, page 286,
notes, when it comes to motzi, every bracha that we make over food has the word bore, except motzi, right? We bore for eis, bore for adama, bore minei mezonot. But when we get to bread, we say hamotzi lechem min haaretz. Why isn't it bore lechem min haaretz? Why is it hamotzi? And he says that part of the way to understand this is actually explicitly through the Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim. And he quotes a passage from the Torah. It says, Ani Hashem Elokechem hamotzi etchem mitachat tzivlot Mitzrayim. I am Hashem who took you out from the suffering you faced in Egypt. And he says there's a connection between these two motzis. He says bread in its most basic form is flour and water. Two ingredients which by themselves you can't really eat. However, when you mix them together in the right amounts, they emerge as something new. They become something, they unite together and they become something that you can't eat, that you can't have sustenance on. He says, similarly with Bnei Israel, when we went into Mitzrayim, yes, we were an extended family, but with many extended families, you know, everyone knows each other and they, you know, that's fine, but they're not united per se. And he says that our experience in Mitzrayim was really an experience that united us beyond just being an extended family, but really saying now we are one nation. Our experience in Mitzrayim specifically is what turned us into the nation of Israel. So now that we're a nation, how do we relate to Hashem? Because we're saying that Hashem put us in Mitzrayim, and He did put us there specifically to make us into this nation. So how did this new nationhood affect our relationship? Rabbi Levi Yitzchak of Berditch of the Kedushat Levi, in his book Kedushat Levi on Parshat Bo, he notes that there's an interesting difference. Now if I was to ask an interesting distinction, if I was to ask anyone in this room what holiday is coming up in 2.5 weeks, what holiday? Pesach, right? Everyone's going to say Pesach. But he says it's kind of not true. Because if you look at Pesach, Pesach is based on the Korban Pesach, which was actually brought on Yud Dalet Nisan, and we celebrate on Tet Vav, on the 15th. It was brought on the 14th, we celebrate on the 15th. And Pesach also has to do with one part of Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim that Hashem passed over the houses of Am Yisrael. Those are two things, one of which we don't do nowadays, unfortunately beyond our control, but one which we don't do, and the other is one part of a story, but that's what we call it. Really, what are we celebrating nowadays? We're celebrating Chag HaMatzot. That's what the Torah actually calls it, Chag HaMatzot. And he says, there's a distinction. These two things relate to different things. Pesach, as we mentioned, talks about the Korban Pesach, Hashem passing over. And it really talks about the fact that Hashem has faith in Am Yisrael that we are worthy of redemption. And he says, Matzah, however, is about our faith in Hashem. That we were willing to leave Mitzrayim in a hurry, that we were willing to leave with only our basic needs. Just a little bit of matzah. That's all we had, and we were willing to say, you know what, even with just this little bit of matzah, I have enough faith in Hashem that I'll get by for however long He wants me in the desert, with just a little bit of matzah. And really, that is what most of our practice of Pesach is based on, and our Siddarim are really based on this idea of matzah, and celebrating our faith in Hashem. And it is really that faith in Hashem which brings us into the ultimate expression of our redemption. And the matzah itself is the representation of this freedom. And so based on this, we can really say that a person who is the person who has the greatest faith is the person who is truly free. And that really, a person who is truly free will not consider at all what somebody else has, but will look to every small thing that they themselves have and recognize that within that, they can be thankful, even with those small things. The truth is, though, and we'll go back to Rav Kook now, that really, it's hard to really value the good things that we have unless we've... It's hard to value it unless we've had a situation where we haven't even had that. Rav Kook asks a particular question. He says, matzah, as we've described, represents freedom. And he says, maror represents our slavery. So we've done motzi, matzah, now we're on maror. Maror represents our slavery. Now, if I was to ask anybody here, in Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim, which came first, the slavery or the freedom? Slavery came first. Meanwhile, what's our order? Masa, and then Maror. Meaning that the order is backwards in the Seder. Really, we should be having Maror before we have Motzi. Because Maror represents our freedom. Our slavery. Masa is representing our freedom. We should go from slavery to freedom. So Rambam says something is backward here. So why is it that everything is reversed? Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, the Ramchal in his book Derech Hashem, and the first part, third chapter, second paragraph, explains that doing Hashem's will only has value if we have the equal opportunity to not do Hashem's will. And Rav Kook takes a similar view when he looks at Matzah and Maror. He says we can truly only value the bitterness that we experienced in slavery from a place of freedom. If somebody is a slave, life is bitter, it's just bitter. You can say, oh, don't worry, it'll be fine. That's nice. They might intellectually know that, but it doesn't mean anything. It's really empty. When somebody's in a place of bitterness, it's just purely bitter. However, once we emerge as a free nation, once somebody in a state of bitterness exits that bitterness and enters a place of freedom, then at that point you can look back and almost find value in the bitterness itself. You can look back and say, I understand the growth that I have to go through in that place. I understand that those challenges pushed me to become a better version of myself, as it were. And Rav Kook actually extends this concept one step further. He says, now that we are free, we can see the value of slavery. And he says, now that we are free, we can, having seen the value of slavery, we can actually choose to enslave ourselves to something positive. He says, now, before we were slaves against our will to Mitzrayim, now we can choose to enslave ourselves to the will of Hashem. And he says, we understand that having this kind of connection can truly push us to grow and to develop, and therefore we almost look for a level of subservience to Hashem, really to say that this is going to help me now emerge more free. And so with that, we can look at Motzi, Matzah, and Maror and recognize that these are part of the journey of Exodus. They bring us from being a group of slaves to being united as a nation. They show us the development of our faith, knowing that even the smallest of our blessings are blessings, and they help us recognize that truly the challenges in life lead us to great states of greater freedom, and that really the challenges we face are ultimately deep down blessings, and we should all really be aware and cognizant of all the blessings we have in our lives, and should really have a wonderful Pesach full of blessings. And with that, I'm going to take one last opportunity to thank Shari Shamayim, to thank Jason and Raquel for sponsoring, thank everyone who came out tonight. Again, if you want the audio recording, sign in sheet at the back, and Mickey will now be making an announcement.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you, Rabbi, for all of your insightful Torah on Pesach and Haggadah. As we now enjoy